when we started doing these back in 2019, it was just the set-aside group, and we did a few. And then last summer, we did an extra one. We did our normal one, then we did another one with District 41. And they cooperated. And then now, you know, District 41 set-aside group and a Big Book Workshop group have come together to form this committee. It's called Triple C's. So that's Charlotte Conference Committee. So, yeah. And, you know, we're, because this, Charlotte used to have the Spring Fling, where it was like a conference and they flew speakers out, and it was a cool thing for Charlotte, you know, and then that went away. And since we're all like people involved in this, we all love Big Book Workshops. We love broadening our perspectives on the Big Book and having people talk about it. And we're all like-minded about that. So we want to kind of turn that into this, where it's like a conference, but we fly out these Big Book speakers. And so please thank you, everybody who had something to do with putting this on. A lot of work went into this. Yeah. And I look forward to hearing these speakers, John and Jared. I think Jared's going to get started. He's going to go from 7 till 9. So let's do a prayer. Let's just follow along with me in your heads. We'll do a set-aside prayer. So, God, please set aside everything I think I know about myself, my illness, the 12 steps, and especially you, so we can have a brand new experience of all these things. Please let us see the truth. Amen. Amen. All right.
How's everybody doing? How's everybody doing? Right on. Good evening, everybody. My name is Jared Dickey, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive, sober, awake, part of the fellowship, part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's always an honor and a privilege to get invited to come to a place like this, to meet new people, to see smiling faces. Because there was a time when I was not invited to go to a lot of places. People would call ahead of time to make sure old Jared was not, your husband's not coming today, is he? I'm serious. So before I get going, a couple of house cleaning things. So who made the coffee tonight? Who made the coffee? That's some Pennzoil high mileage. That's best conference coffee ever, right? Should win an award. I when I poured the first ounce and I couldn't see the bottom, I was like, ha, all right, let's keep going. There we go. Also, one other thing, I know it was already said, but anybody who had anything to do with putting this on, guys, let's give these folks a round of applause. It takes a lot to put some stuff on. It takes some, you know, some time, sometimes some blood, sweat, and tears, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's an honor, again, on behalf of John and myself, to be able to be here. I'm going to set this over here. All right. So I introduce myself as recovered because it's the truth. That is my experience. I don't suffer from some sort of false humility that I'm going to be always recovering, sick and suffering, struggling one silly day at a time. Again, it's not my experience. I've taken 12 steps. I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of those steps, and I no longer think about drinking. Moreover, I no longer think about not drinking. Now think about that. Wrap our heads around that. If the obsession still exists, when I wake up in the morning, I'm thinking two things. How can I get it? How can I stay away from it? Either way, I'm a slave, right? And I put myself there. So I'm the prisoner and I'm the jailer. But fortunately, through this program, and more importantly, the power of God, I don't have to think about drinking. And I don't have to think about not drinking. I'm placed in a position of neutrality. And that's a cool deal. And that's what we have to sell. Right? That's what any of us have to sell. That's our obligation, our responsibilities. We sell freedom. We sell God. That's why we're here this weekend, right? About God. Right? Because if it was not for God, we wouldn't be here. Plain and simple. Right? But there's a whole lot of stuff that we got to get through to get to that point. Right? And so I know from talking with Mitchell and a couple of other folks, y'all's past experience with this, this might be a little bit different because, you know, we could come up here, we could tell our story and stuff like that for the first night, and then we could start getting into the meat and potatoes tomorrow. But we kind of figured, you know what, we're going to be giving our experience with this, you know, going through the steps and kind of our story throughout the entire, you know, weekend. So we might as well just skip that part and go straight into the fun stuff, right? The fun stuff. And she laughed. I got one laugh out of that. If you got a book, everybody is welcome to thumb along, right? Look at that. Everybody's bringing their book. I love it. It's awesome. We're home. I'm home. I have arrived. So check it out. I'm going to start talking about some step one stuff. But before we kind of get into that, we got to talk about a couple of things prior to that. Just to get a feel of the room, do I have anybody here who's got, let's say, anybody with more than like 20 years of sobriety? Okay, we got a handful of folks. All right, anybody between 10 and 20? Okay, how about 1 and 5 years? Right, anybody in like their first 30 days? Right on. Good. Anybody within, like, say, their first 10, 15 days? Nope, that's okay. It's quite all right. So I know that in some cases we may be here, and we're probably preaching to the choir in some cases, but as many of us, I'm sure, have found, whether it's at a conference, whether it's sitting knee-to-knee with another drunk, as we're going through some of this, we begin to have a new experience with it. And just like the set aside or the lay aside prayer says, allow me to set aside everything that I think I know for an open mind and a new experience today, and help me see my truth. And oftentimes, if you're going through the steps the first time, or maybe you've had some AA experience, and you know you perhaps relapsed and you're coming back into it, that's what we always want to gain. Is we want to gain a new experience, not just with the work, but a new experience with ourselves. A new experience with the book, which is the program, and not only that, a new experience with God, right? Because our old experience hasn't been working, right? At least in that particular example. So, do I have any chronic relapsers in here? We just call them alcoholics, right? It's pretty much what it is. So I'm going to do what I always do, right? But we want to put a label on it and call it chronic relapsers, right? So in my personal experience, I would drink, I'm the type of person who could not drink. And when I first kind of felt like I had an inkling of a problem, I went to the first group that I could find, right? Stone's throw from my house, thinking that every single group was gonna be the same, because that's what I saw on TV, right? That it was gonna be cool. So I showed up, the coffee was warm, the hugs were nice, you know what I mean? People were greeting me and all of that. And what ended up happening is they set me down and they say, hey guys, Jared's brand new, so let's go around the room and let's tell him how we got here. I'm like, oh, okay, so this ought to be interesting. You know, it felt kind of like a little kid swinging my legs off the chair, you know what I mean? Just waiting to hear story time. And we start over here in this side of the room, you know, and this person's got a DWI. And I'm like, well, that hadn't happened yet. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm just going to listen. And we make it down to the middle of the room, and this dude's got 60 DWIs, and it's like, oh boy, you know. And then we make it around over here to the end. This guy's got like 13 DWIs, and he's like cut people up and put them in plastic bags and stuff like that. And I'm like, heavens, I haven't done any of this stuff. I must not be an alcoholic. And that's how I would try to relate, and that's how I would identify, is because of external circumstances or consequences, repercussions from what these people have from their drinking, but I hadn't made it there yet, right? But I did what they asked me to do. They said, meeting makers make it, do 90 and 90, and all sorts of other well-meaning, you know, slogans and stuff like that. And so like any good alcoholic, I did 270 and 90. I still find myself drinking before the meeting, after the meeting, and even during the meeting. One particular group I went to started offering Desire chips or, you know, 24-hour chips before and after the meeting, because you know who would slip off to the bathroom, right? That's the kind of drinker I was. But at no point in time did anybody stop me and tell me, hey, this is what you may be suffering from, or this is the solution, you know, to get away from what you're suffering from, right? No one corralled me up. No one showed me this. You know what I mean? And I floundered for several years in that meeting, almost dying three times. And it wasn't until I had made it to like my fifth treatment center, I think, I got wrapped up with a couple of guys who were twins, you may know them. And they told me to go, you know, get hooked up at this one particular meeting. They're studying the book. The lights are on. They're awake. These folks are free. And I got hooked up there. And I still floundered for another couple of years. But what I did here was a real solution, and I got a head full of the big book. And for any of the folks who are chronic relapsers in here, it's really, really difficult to drink on a head full of the big book. Well, it's not difficult to drink. I'm going to do it. But it makes it worse, you know what I mean, with a head full of the big book. So it wasn't until I made it to that meeting, and I had been floundering, that this is what I knew about getting sober. Staying sober. If you can see it, it's a blank page, right? 5 years in AA, just being a meeting maker, right? This is what I knew about getting sober and staying sober. I didn't know squat, nothing, right? But now, for the sake of the talk, let's go on to the title page, right? We got something here that's pretty awesome. It says, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, right? Past tense. So if I'm a newcomer and I show up and I see on the title page that these people have recovered, right? Then I'm gonna be a little intrigued, especially if I'm in and out, you know what I mean? It doesn't say that they're always recovering, right? It says that they have recovered, past tense. I'm a little intrigued, I wanna find out why they did it. How did they do it, right? So let's thumb on over here to the preface. And this is just to kind of ease us into what we're talking about, right? So the preface, second paragraph, it basically qualifies this book, right? It calls it the basic text of our society. So what do we do with a textbook? Anybody? Study it. That's right. Think about back in the day, everybody's in math class, teacher hands out math books, right? I can't just jump to the back and start working long division. No, I got to start in the beginning. Let's start learning about numbers, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. Each chapter builds upon itself. It's going to give me a problem. It'll give me a solution, then it'll give me a program of action to get from problem to solution, right? So it's a textbook. It's not like a novel. It's not like the latest John Grisham, right? I'm just going to read it, put it back on the shelf, and it collects dust for several years until it goes to a garage sale, perhaps. Right? No, it's a textbook. In order to be a student and practitioner of this program, I need to know what's in this book. I need to become the book. The book needs to become me, right? So let's thumb on over here to forward to the first edition. Right? It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right? Recovered. There's that magical word again. You don't suppose they meant recovered, right? From a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right? For me, like I said, I'm the type of person who could not drink. I drink from the moment that I came to the moment that I passed out, day in and day out. I couldn't live with the drink, and I couldn't live without the drink. It was killing me, but I had to drink to live. It's kind of a conundrum. I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place. But these folks found a way out. So it says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. All right, so who can tell me what precisely means? Exact, right? Exactly. Clear cut, no gray area. Moreover, not up for interpretation, right? It's here in black and white, clear as crystal. So if I want what these people have, I need to do precisely as they did. Oftentimes we may hear out there, and it could be semantics sometimes, oh, well, they're just not working their program. Oh, for my program, I need to do this. You know, there's no my program. There's no her program. There's no their program. There's only the program, right? If I work Jared's program, wear a helmet. Because it's going to get ugly pretty fast, okay? Me working my program, living life on life's terms, gets me thirsty. And I do what we always do. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. There's tons of awesome books out there about getting sober, staying sober, living sober. And they're good books. I suggest if you have some time, you can read them, right? But nowhere else on God's green earth will it give me precise instructions on how to work the 12 steps than in this book. Right? Think about it this way. You show up to treatment. Or at least as I did, they gave me two books, right? They gave me the big book, and they gave me the 12 and 12, right? And I'm sitting here looking. I don't like reading at all. Oh, neither book has pictures. Well, I'm going to go with the smaller book, okay? I'm going to go with the Cliff Notes. That's what I thought it was, okay? The 12 and 12 is written by Bill Wilson when he's umpteen years sober, reflecting on what the steps meant to him at that time. So like we were kind of having a conversation at the table a little bit earlier, that's like a newcomer, you know, showing up to somebody who's already been, you know, 20 years sober saying, okay, great, how do I get from here to there, you know? And page 17 in the 12 and 12 says, always defer back to this book, right? This is the instruction manual. This is the recipe for a miracle that I have right here in front of me. So I always defer back to this. Says, we think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic, and many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we're sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. True statement. We'll look at the little picture, and then we'll go to the big picture. So since I've been sober, since I've been free, I get an opportunity to come here and speak with you guys. I get to be my daughter's soccer coach. Right? I get to be a part of my kids' lives, you know what I mean? I get to go to work. I get to be an effective member of society. I get to do a lot of things, right? Since this book was published in 1939, it's given birth to over like 250 plus 12-step fellowships, right? That's the bigger picture. They saw that it was working in alcoholics, and they said, hey, let's turn it over to our specific problem, especially for identification purposes, and guess what? It worked. Suffice to say that when applied, the 12 steps are going to solve my problem. So I'll kind of skip over a couple of things. The one thing that I do really want to hit on, and I also need to keep track of time, is in the foreword to the second edition. Okay? So there's a lot of, on page XX, I think it is for you guys. My book's numbered a little bit differently. You'll see some percentages up there. Right? This is the controversial part. It says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 50%. Wow. That's pretty righteous. There's not a treatment center on this planet that sniffs 50%. And these guys got 50%. You know what I mean? They must have been doing something right. Half the room, right? 50 out of 100. So it goes on to say, 25% sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on AA showed improvement, okay? So you had some folks like me who had to go in and, you know, find out about AA, and then I go out and have to do some more research, right, on my own in the gutter, and then I come back and say, hey, what's this AA thing you guys are doing again? Right? So we're up to 75% now. You kind of go back into the archives, even in, like, Akron, Cleveland area, these guys were knocking out, like, 9 out of 10. Right? 92% success rate. Dr. Bob's group today is still doing something similar to that. So what were they doing? You hear all sorts of things these days like, oh, less than 5% of people will achieve 5% of sobriety or 5 years of sobriety, you know what I mean? All sorts of weird percentages that I don't even know if are founded in fact. Why? Because we're an anonymous bunch, you know? So where did these things come from? You may be asking, where did these particular percentages come from? Well, in AA, I think it's AA Comes of Age and Dr. Bob, the Good Old Timers, I think they referenced this, right? They sent out a little questionnaire in some of the early groups. They said, you know, what's your group's name? How many people are staying sober? How many people do you have in your group? You know what I mean? That kind of thing, right? So it's not empirical evidence, but it's what they found to be true at the time. And so, you know, where did we go from now to back then, where we have such a poor success rate, supposedly? Right? Drugs? No. Drugs have been around for a long time, okay? Towns Hospital, world famous for sobering up alcoholics and heroin addicts, okay? It's been around for a long while. Problems? No. Problems have been the same, right? They don't get worse. There's still problems, right? These guys were coming out of World War I, about to go into World War II, through the Great Depression. They had some problems, right? So let's put it this way. Let's lay it out how they used to do back in the days, and let's see if it chalks up with any of our experience currently, okay? So let's say we got a knucklehead who's sitting in treatment center. What was the one you were telling me about, Mitch? CCR, something like that? All right, we got a knucklehead who's sweating it out in the CCR place. He's detoxing, right? And so me and a couple of AAs, we go over there and we talk to him. We find out all we can about him. We let him know about us, and then we leave. Come back the next day, we do the same exact thing. Then we leave. Day three or four rolls around, and we do the same exact thing. And by the time we're ready to leave, this guy says, hey, wait a minute. You guys drank as much, if not more, than I ever dreamed of. You're free. You get to go home to your hot little wives and your kids and stuff, and I get to still sweat it out here. You know, what did you guys do? Now I got it, right? And I set the hook, right? In a very short amount of time, I've become this man's sponsor, right? He's my protege, my prospect, whatever you want to call it. I take this man through the steps in a very short amount of time, and now he's had a spiritual awakening as the result of going through the work, right? At a rapid fire pace. And now he's back in CCR, right? Not as a patient. Now he's 12-stepping those other knuckleheads in there. Right? Notice we didn't say anything about sitting in a meeting talking about my dog peeing on the rug again, or the divorce, or anything like that, right? These guys took action. They realized their lives were in jeopardy, and in order to save their own lives, they went out to go help other people, right? So now we get into the problem, okay? If you're in the book, go ahead and thumb on over here to the doctor's opinion, Roman numeral 28. And this is where I gotta kinda pick up the pace, so listen fast. All right, so now we're in the doctor's opinion. Without the doctor's opinion, this book probably wouldn't have carried as much weight at the time as it did, right? Fortunately, Dr. Silkworth, who a majority of the contribution in this chapter is written by, a gentleman by the name of William Duncan Silkworth, at the time was pretty much one of the nation's foremost authorities on alcoholics, and like we said earlier, heroin addicts, right? Throughout his tenure at Towns Hospital, worked with several thousand people like us. And he specialized in, and as you may read in the book, people who suffer from alcoholic and drug addiction, right? He specialized in the people who were chemically dependent, okay? Which is a big difference than being the real deal. Sometimes they may go hand in hand, right? But what he was specialized in was those people who were dependent, right? And so he noticed two different types of people who would come into Towns Hospital, right? Group A would come in, they'd get, you know, the treatment du jour, the belladonna treatment, hydrotherapy, they'd hear the lectures, they'd get the meds, sleep in the stiff beds, you know what I mean, eat the food, they'd leave, and they'd never come back. And then you get somebody like me, who I'd show up, I'd get the same meds, the same treatment, the same hydrotherapy, same food, and I'd leave faring forth in high hopes, but then I'd always return. And I'm 10 times worse than the time that I was there before, right? Anybody have that experience? Yes, exactly, right? So that's when he developed this opinion or theory, right? Later on, and I believe in 48, it was accepted by the American Medical Association as fact, right? So this is what he found to be true. Roman numeral 28 says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, and that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So if you're like me and I'm sitting in treatment and I hear someone lay this on me, I'm like, this sounds like a whole lot of doctor talk. Can someone dumb it down, please? Or just slow down, you know what I mean? So basically what he's saying is that he notices something that happens differently in chronic alcoholics. Chronic meaning occurring frequently, difficult to eradicate. Right? Something that happens that didn't occur in the other type of folks, the group A folks that we talked about, right? And so he's starting to develop this, and he thinks that whatever is happening to them is similar to an allergy, right? An allergy being an abnormal reaction that my body has to something it comes in contact with, right? So we'll put it this way. Like, everybody likes to use what? Strawberries, penicillin, that kind of thing. How about bee stings? Anybody allergic to bees? Nobody in here, surprisingly. Okay. Think about it this way. If I'm allergic to bees and I get stung by a bee, how does this allergy manifest itself? My throat swells up. Maybe I break out into hives. I might need an EpiPen, right? That kind of thing. Can I control how my body reacts to it? No, I can't. It's beyond my physical and mental control. So now let's talk about alcohol. For the real alcoholic, for the chronic alcoholic, whenever I put alcohol in my body, the way that this allergy manifests itself is in the form of a craving, right? One will always lead to more, right? And so what we have to understand is it's not the idea of quantity that we're talking about, it's the idea of control. Can I control how much I drink every single time, right? Every single time. That's the important part of the question. Because a lot of us may go back to, oh, well, remember that time when we went to the Journey concert and I was the designated driver, you know what I mean? That one time. No, we're talking about every single time, right? Anybody been to the liquor store more than once in a day? Yeah. Better yet, who's been to the ATM more than once in a day? Okay. Get a feel for the crowd. We know who's out there now. Wink, wink. Why didn't I get enough in the beginning, right? Because I'm setting off to just, you know, all I want is one tall boy, right? Maybe I'm just going to set off, all I want is a pint, right? Problem is, though, is I go back and forth to the liquor store so many times that I should have just bought the handle in the beginning. You know what I mean? But what I'm doing is I'm setting out to control it. All I want, I just want to get right. Not drinking to escape, not drinking to, you know, fight away what's going on in my head or whatever. I just want to get right, okay? I want to be a part of, and that's all I'm setting off to do, right? I just want a little bit of medicine to be able to fit in, to do what I need to do, right? To get the job done, get the day going, that kind of thing, so I can do the chores. Problem is, though, is once I put it in, it's beyond my physical control, and I'm off to the races each and every single time. Does that make sense? Right. But what we have to understand is it only occurs in chronic alcoholics, real alcoholics. So that means that there's other types of drinkers out there. The book talks about that, page 20 and 21. You're welcome to put your thumb on this page and you can go to 20 and 21, right? Real quick, it describes a couple of different drinkers. It's got the moderate drinker, right? Anybody who can take it or leave it alone. I kind of liken it to a lot of the girls that I dated in college. You know, I'm like 6 or 7 drinks in. She's still nursing a half a glass of wine. I think we all have a friend like that. I'm about to order another and I'd say, hey honey, you know, you want me to get you another one? And she'd say, no, I'm starting to feel it. That's the whole point. Do you want another one? Or maybe the other one is, it's gotten warm. Nothing ever stopped me from drinking boiling hot turkey 101 that's been sitting underneath my truck seat on a 110 degree day, right? Didn't stop me. Temperature was not a factor, okay? Suffice to say, a moderate drinker can take it or leave it alone, right? That's a long example, sorry. Now we got a hard drinker, and this is where it gets a little difficult because on the outside, a hard drinker kind of looks like an alcoholic, right? Falling off the same bar stools, gotten kicked out of the same places, caused some ruckus, that kind of thing, right? The difference between them and myself is that they may find it difficult, they may find it troublesome, might need medical attention, but the bigger difference is that if they have an active reason, right, they can stop, they can moderate, right? What is that reasoning? Well, ill health, falling in love, warning of a doctor. You know, doctor says, dude, you're going to drink up your liver. You better slow it down. The wife says, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm taking the kids. You know, boss says, dude, you can't show up drunk again. I'm going to have to let you go if you do. Right? These are sufficient reasons, right? That where a hard drinker, no matter how far they've gone, can pull up, they could stop, they can moderate. But as the book tells us, they may find it difficult, may find it troublesome, might need medical attention. So what does that tell me? Hard drinkers show up in treatment. Treatment does wonders for hard drinkers. They may show up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why it's our responsibility, it's our obligation to stand ready at the door, like the responsibility statement says, but to qualify the cat who walks in. Anybody who comes in, right? If you have an honest desire to be here, to stop drinking, great, you can be a member. Doesn't mean you're a real alcoholic, right? That's why we have to qualify. We'll talk about that part tomorrow. So moving on, back over here on Roman numeral 28, to finish out that first paragraph, it says, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit, found they cannot break it, having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Treatment centers 1 through 3 told me that that is why my life is unmanageable. That's not unmanageability. Those are consequences. Those are results of my drinking. Anybody who goes out there and drinks copious amounts of booze is going to have some problems, right? And this is what they look like. So we have to understand that alcoholism itself, right, is an internal condition, right, caused by internal things. The physical allergy, right, the physiological piece of within my body, and not only that, the mental piece that we'll talk about here in 2 seconds, that all occurs in my body. Nothing outside of me caused me to be this way, and nothing outside of me is going to fix it. Right? A lot of times we put the blame on a lot of stuff that we've gone through, and I'll tell you this. As I'm not making light of any traumatic experience that anybody may have gone through, whether it's as a child, teenager, adult, even recently, right? I'm not making light of any of that stuff. But it didn't cause me to be what I am. It's all based on an internal condition. Now, it may exacerbate the problem. It may make it worse. I might drink over that stuff, right? But it didn't cause me to be what I am. Moving on, down here at the bottom, it talks about why anybody drinks. Men and women drink Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So true, right? I don't know anybody who really drinks for the taste. I love the taste of Dr. Pepper, but I'm not going to sit alone in the dark in my back bedroom and drink a whole case of Dr. Pepper. I'm just not going to do it. Right? I'm going for the effect. Think about the first time you ever got drunk. Right? I know everybody remembers it. How did you feel? For me, it was like 10 feet tall. I grew muscles somehow. I was a way better dancer, which was beneficial for the ladies. But I locked that into long-term memory, right? I'm always going for that effect. Why? Because it worked. I'm always going back to when it worked. Problem is, though, is that I now have this physical piece that eliminates my control factor, and I overshoot the mark each and every single time. And that takes us into the next sentence. It says, the sensation is so elusive, I'm always trying to catch it. It's elusive. That while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. We've all got injuries, okay? We could all go around the room and we'd hear plenty of sob stories. But I definitely have 2 that we can get down with right now. Internal stuff. Anybody ever experienced loss of dignity? Loss of self-respect. Alcohol ever gets you to do things you said you would never do? Go places you said you never go? All of these things, right? Yeah, we might as well just keep them up, right? That after a time, we cannot differentiate the true from the false. The truth is I drink, I get drunk, bad things happen. The false is all of the things that my mind will try to trick me into to take me back to the drink, to justify another drink. It'll pretty up a junkyard to take me back to the very thing that's trying to kill me. And I'll always get drunk on a lie, never on the truth. The truth from the false, right? Who's ever said, you know what, this time it'll be different? My personal fave, who's gonna know? Yes, Like, I'm going to act my way out of it. It's very difficult to act your way out of it when you're doing this. Like I'm on a boat. Anyway. Or I might just say, screw it. Right? Get a case of the efforts, you know what I mean? Or I may experience what the book describes as a strange mental blank spot, which just means that I'm struck drunk. I don't recall how it happened. Right? I come to 14 days later, haven't put an ounce of food in my body, which was my experience, haven't showered, haven't drank water. I'm living on Turkey 101 and Fruit Punch 4 Locos. Right? And, yep, got some 4 Loko fans back there. Wretches. Me too, I'm with you. And I'm wondering, I don't recall buying it. I don't recall stealing it. I don't recall putting it to my lips. All I know is that I'm drunk again, right? And so it goes on to say that to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. It becomes normal for me to lie, to manipulate, to continue to set the bar lower and lower and lower, right? It becomes normal for me to hurt the ones that I love. Oh, that's never my intention, right? My mama raised me to know right from wrong. I was an Eagle Scout, right? I know what it means to be trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. But the needed power is not there, right? Because of my mind, right? And as we find out a little bit later, the main problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. Right? But a couple of key factors before we get into that is the next sentence. It says, they're restless, irritable, and discontented, right? That is untreated alcoholism to a T, okay? Restless, right? My mind's going 100 different directions. I'm driving down here, and I got 40 conversations going, and I'm the only one in the car. You know? Or you've seen that dude in treatment who's got that jumpy leg. You know what I mean? His leg's just bouncing 100 miles. He's going to punch a hole in the floor. You know what I mean? Restless. Okay? We can use a modern-day term and call that anxiety. Okay? We got irritable. Right? That's the next one. Wake up in the morning, it's going to be the best day in the world. Walk into the kitchen, the kids are crying. My wife's burnt the bacon. Now I fly off the handle, right? Just need a reason to justify me getting angry, right? Discontented, right? We'll use a modern day term with that. That could be depression, right? Discontented is a double-edged sword. On one end, it looks like a whole lot of self-pity. Poor me. My mama loves my brother more than she loves me. I gotta sleep on a mat at the treatment center. You know what I mean? I could have 5 years of sobriety and all I got is 5 days. That kind of thing. Poor me. Or it can look like what Fred's story looks like. Okay? It's the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. But what does Fred's mind come up with? Drink. Right? So does Fred need to put cloudless horizons and perfect days on his trigger list? No. As we've already discussed, nothing outside of me is going to cause me to drink. It's all based on this internal condition. Fred was 100%. But what did his mind say? Drink? Why is that? Because I could always be 110. I'm not content with being 100%. That's how discontent jumps up and gets me. And if I experience these things long enough, I get to begin to experience dis-ease, right? Dis-ease and discomfort. And I want ease and comfort. And that's when my mind says, you know what? I don't like how I feel right now. This sucks. I know what'll fix it. And I'm right back into the very thing that started the whole mess. Is that making sense? Yeah. It says, they're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Right? And it goes on to describe the cycle, the relapse cycle. You know what I mean? It says they succumb to the desire again, as so many do. Phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree. Then they emerge remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. Right? But it's repeated over and over again. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. So check it out. Back there drinking, we were experiencing psychic changes all the time. How did you feel whenever you're driving to the liquor store? Juiced. Juiced. How about whenever you put it to your lips? Right? Whenever I do that, I'm not thinking about the car or the job or the girl, right? I've had a psychic change. But fast forward and this physical piece has developed and I overshoot the mark each and every time, guess what? This psychic change is killing me. And I need to find a newer psychic change, an entire psychic change, right? So let's thumb on over here to page 24, right? If you think we've hit some doom and gloom, we're not there yet, but it's coming, right? So page 24, we got some italicized writing here. And as many of you probably know, that if it's italicized in this book, that means they spent a little extra dough to make it important, right? So it's something that we really need to pay attention to. So it goes on to say that the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent, and we are unable at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week to a month ago. We're without defense against the first drink. Okay? It's easy to sit up here and read that to you, right? But have you experienced that? Think about the worst possible thing that's ever happened to you directly related to booze. What were you doing 24 or 48 hours later? Drinking? Me too. How about a week to a month later? Drinking, right? So think about it this way. In a lot of contemporary AA meetings today, you may hear people that say, keep it green. Remember where you come from. Play your tape through. What are some more? I'm sure there's more. Live life on life's terms, right? Do the next right thing. Coming from well-meaning people, right? Well-meaning people who have a great heart, their intent is not to hurt anybody. But they haven't read this paragraph. This paragraph renders almost every slogan null and void. Why? Because at certain times, I'm not going to be able to keep it green. At certain times, I'm not going to be able to remember where I come from. At certain times, I'm not going to be able to do the next right thing. Right? At certain times, these things may come up into my mind, but they're not sufficient enough. They're not strong enough. They're not powerful enough to keep me away from the next drink. Right? So step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Right? Two separate ideas conjoined by the hyphen. Right? Now, I have no power, choice, and control in the body when I put it in. I have no power, choice, and control in the mind to keep me from putting it in. But what about unmanageability? It's not the external stuff. It's that I cannot manage the decision to stay away from it to save my own life. That is unmanageability, right? Plain and simple. But what comes with it is all the aftermath, right? The external stuff that a lot of people like to talk about. But this is all coming from an internal place, right? And at certain times, I will do the most insane thing that I will ever do in my entire life, and that's pick up another drink. And I do that from a state of consciousness known as sobriety. Think about that, right? The craziest thing I'll ever do in my entire life, I do stone cold sober, and that's pick up another drink. That's like standing on the train tracks and saying a train won't come this time. Eventually it will come. Doesn't mean it's going to come today. May not even come tomorrow. But sometime down the road, guess what? It's going to come. Does anybody want to be on the train track? No. Because it will obliterate me. And that's what alcohol does with me every single time. Right? So this oftentimes is the hardest part for a lot of people to get around. Speaking from a sponsorship standpoint, when qualifying somebody else and we ask them these two questions, it's important to get down to the nuts and bolts, right? Page 44 gives us these two questions, okay? And then we'll backtrack to page 30 after we talk about this. So page 44 says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, right? Entirely means for good and for all together, right? Not one day at a time, right? Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Now, guess what? It throws in a trap word. Probably. Right? Probably. Why does it say probably? Well, because I can't diagnose you. Your doctor can't diagnose you. Your therapist can't diagnose you. Right? I have to diagnose me. One of the deadliest illnesses known to mankind, an illness that kills people that don't even drink, and I have to self-diagnose. It's nuts. It's nuts. Right? It kills people that don't even drink. Strangely enough, the unique ability of this illness is so strong that it will try to trick me into thinking that I don't even have an illness. Right? A lot of times people will say, oh, well, alcoholics are just in denial. No, we're not. Delusion. Delusion is when I'm sick, but I can't even tell that I'm sick. Right? And that's the same way with this illness. It will try to trick me into thinking that I don't even have an illness. And you know, a lot of us will have to go through a lot of things. You know, let's go to page 30 just real quick. So here in the chapter, more about alcoholism. Excuse me. So no person likes to admit he's bodily and mentally different than his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. You got any provers out here? Yes, provers. Better yet, do I have any hiders? Anybody like to hide it? Yes. Perfectly legal substance, and I'm hiding it. All over the house. So well that I hide it from myself. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing, and many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Now here's the fun part. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery, right? This. But wait a minute, I thought step one says we admitted we were powerless and no, this. Right? This is the first step in recovery. What good is the solution if I don't know what my problem is? Now, if you're like me, several years ago, maybe in more than a couple of decades, if someone has said, Jared, are you an alcoholic? I would have been like, yep. I could admit that to you intellectually. I knew that I had a problem intellectually, right? But I can't use a sick mind to heal a sick mind. What am I taking with me every place that I go? My sick mind, right? It's always with me. I can't get rid of it. And that's where the main problem for the alcoholic lies. Okay? So many of us would say, why did I have to go through the things that I went through? Why did I have to experience some of the things that I experienced when I was out there drinking, when I was out there getting my teeth kicked in time after time, year after year? Some of us, decade after decade, right? All of it is absolutely necessary for me to go through for this idea to travel from my head to my heart. Because where do I have to concede? My innermost self, in my heart of hearts, in my gut, in my spirit, right? And that's where things are going to start to change. The book says honesty and willingness are indispensable, but I tell you what, you give me desperation any day. Desperation is the catalyst for honesty. Desperation is the catalyst for willingness. When am I most willing to do something that I do not want to do? When I'm desperate, right? When I'm absolutely desperate. But unfortunately, ego reconstructs itself, right? If you, yes, you too, huh? Yeah. If you're familiar with the guy named Dr. Harry Tebow, he wrote extensively about the reemergence of ego or the reconstruction of ego, the alcoholic ego, right? That's why the book says I have a week to a month. If you want to know what the time frame is with which to work the steps, page 24 just tells you, a week to a month. That's the timeline. Why? Because at some point in time, unless I'm seeking a spiritual solution, my mind will give way to a trivial excuse to pick up another drink, right? And so I need a spiritual airbag between me and the next drink. And how do I get that? By going through the rest of the work. But what good is the rest of the work if I don't know in here what I am? Right? Am I the real deal? Am I a real alcoholic? Right? Am I suffering from an illness that is progressive in nature and left untreated is 100% fatal? 100%. No different than cancer or any other illness out there. You leave it alone. You don't touch it. You don't treat it. What does it do? Consumes the host and the host dies. Stark and ugly fact, right? But fear won't sober me up. Right? But desperation is a good way to start. Right? You give me desperation any day. The book even uses the example that we had to tackle this with the desperation of a drowning man. Right? If I'm anybody in here almost drowned? Right? Okay. Sorry to hear that. Glad you're still here. Okay. Not making light of it, but check it out. If I'm drowning, I'm thinking of one thing. Breathe air, not water. That's it. I'm not thinking about the car or the job or the girl or anything like that. Breathe air, not water. So if that's the case, and a hand comes down to help me, am I going to say, oh, how long have you been doing this? Sorry, I can only help, or I can only receive help from someone who's been doing this for 2 years. Moreover, am I going to question the color of the hand? No. That person's breathing air. I want air. Let's go. I'm desperate. Right? September the 5th, 2015, right? That's my sobriety date. I met a level of desperation that since then has not been matched. Right? Going in and out, 1, 2, 3, out, 1, 2, 3, 4, out, all the way up to amends. Oh no, I'm out. Having to remake amends. I'm out. That's a rough deal. Don't recommend that. But I was defeated, right? I was at a point where suicide was a player, right? Doesn't happen for everybody, but I didn't want to drink. But this obsession owned me, right? It's all I thought about in my waking moments, in my unwaking moments, right? Conscious or unconscious is what I always thought about, right? And I was a slave, and I put myself there. Nobody put me there, right? And so I was at the point that the book talks about where what makes a man willing to make the supreme sacrifice? What is the supreme sacrifice? Taking myself out. But this started when I want so desperately not to drink, but accepting drastic and revolutionary proposals is still, I don't know. You know what I mean? Isn't that funny? How people will say, okay, well, I have a solution. This is what we got to do, drastic and revolutionary proposals. And you were like, can you just give me a couple of minutes to think it over? Or we want to analyze. I just need charts and graphs, you know what I mean? I'm typing stuff up. Okay, yeah, okay. I like what you've done here. That's good, you know. When all it needs to take is for me to pick up a simple kit of spiritual tools that are laid at my feet. Why? Because I'm beyond human aid, right? If this is me, if I'm the person on page 24, then I'm beyond human aid. No amount of love, no amount of consequences is going to keep me away from the drink, right? I will do what I always do. And step one does not tell me that you can't drink. Step one says, you will drink. If this is you, you are condemned to do exactly what you've always done over and over and over again. You know the definition of insanity, regular folks' definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results? Well, the alcoholic definition is doing the same thing over and over again, damn well knowing what's going to happen, but doing it anyway. Right? That's nuts. Right? The book uses the example of putting my hand on a hot stove. Right? So on to this idea of desperation and the shelf life, and then I'm going to turn over, or we'll take a little break, and then it'll be John's turn, is, you know, you give me a few days, maybe even a week or two, of getting some good food in me. You know, I'm sitting in treatment, and you know, I maybe got some good meds. The beds aren't so bad. I've actually showered. You know what I mean? Maybe we're parting the wild horse's mane on the beach, doing Tai Chi, these things. Maybe the girls still have all their teeth. You know what I mean? It's a good thing, right? I'm sitting in a really good spot. You know what I mean? And you give me a few days, couple of weeks of this. Guess what? My mind says, you know what? Dude, you were just kind of making rough going of this. You know what I mean? It's cool that you're here. You know what I mean? You can kind of get your priorities straight. But you know what? When we get out there, we're just going to do this. I'm just going to do that. I'm going to do this. I'm going to not hang out with these folks. I'm going to do this. You know what I mean? And I'm going to try all sorts of things, right? Anything but this. I'm going to go out and buy a $300 vape. I'm going to go out there and get a gym membership, right? I'm going to switch from blondes to brunettes. You know what I mean? I'm going to try all of these things, and those things will work up until the point that they don't. And then my mind says, this sucks. I know it'll fix it. Now I'm restless, irritable, discontent. And guess what? For me to drink is to die. And I'm right back into it again, and it repeats over and over and over again, right? And I'm condemned to do that, right? But the fortunate part, bless you, is that there's hope out there, right? We have a way out that we can all agree on. And John is going to talk to you about that. Thank you guys for listening. Let's go take how long of a break do we need to take? 5, 10 minutes? 10 minutes? Okay. So we'll take a 10-minute break. Thank you guys. Get some of that Pennzoil that's in the thing over there. Mm-hmm.